We're here at the Q Reports. Just a little bit late today. I'm Mark Marabella.
I'm Ed Grant.
I am...
He is Lobo, Patrick Martins.
The Lone Wolf.
The Wolf Man. Remember him?
Yeah.
Were you there at the Harley-Davidson Cafe with Michelle O'Recklin when we went and he was having a Lifetime Achievement Award given to him?
No.
It was by pure chance. God, destiny.
How did I miss that?
That was awesome.
He started very much, it's an apropos, he started very much in pirate radio, supposedly from across the border, Mexican radio.
Yeah. It was Mexican radio, not pirate radio. Big difference.
Mexican radio from across the border where they could pump in
super strong that signals that just blew
that,
through.
That culturally dangerous thing called rock and roll.
Yes.
As it turns out, maybe they were right. I don't know.
They could have been. Well, we have got a we have a great show today, don't we?
We have a green show today.
Another green show.
Yeah.
This one's about outdoor green.
Yeah, this is interesting because I think everybody is interested in green spaces no matter where you are and what environment. And we have some very unique green spaces and how they're,
how a city goes about getting new ones,
and how its citizens work with them within their work in their community, and how they're used, and it's very interesting, very exciting. It's called the High Line. People who don't know, which we should say
this sounds like a drug show. Green High Line. We should just say what we mean by green.
Plants. Oh wait a minute.
Whoa. I'm really
Puff the Magic Dragon.
Yeah. No, it's the High Line, for those of you who don't know. It's an elevated train and tracks on the west side of Manhattan that got repurposed as a park, and it just opened this last week, I guess.
I have a lot of questions about that, actually, having been... Ed, your subjects in your photography is very similar to... I respond greatly to them because it's similar to how I grew up in a rural area with in Buffalo, but in a rural place near Buffalo, really, in farmland. And sort of the deleterious of industrial, decay all around. And I played on railroad tracks all the time as a kid. So this is a very interesting thing to me. But in the middle of a city,
like in Burlington, Vermont, they really did a cool thing where there was, a rail yard and train tracks running all along Lake Champlain that was just not being used. It was all run down. And finally, through pressure from students and the community, the city bought it and turned it into this lovely park and bike path that just runs, all along the lake.
It's all cleared out and it has all that carborundum. Nothing's going to grow there. So it's a perfect place to put blacktop for a bike path. Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, green spaces. I mean, New York City has a real interesting history with green spaces. I mean, people used to have to play and walk and relax in cemeteries because that was the only green space until Olmsted came around or whatever the grid system. I don't know what quite launched it, but... Central Park. I mean, what would the city be without that park?
Central Park, Park Slope, and Delaware Park in Buffalo as well. Olmsted, New York City had a big impact.
But you have to say, the grid came first, but the fact that they...
1811.
That they isolated so much acreage to keep as a park was remarkable for planning.
This would be one of the most polluted cities in the country, in the world, I bet, without Central Park.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, that's true. I mean, you talk about just for there's so many things that open up with green space, of course. People immediately think, oh, it's a park and you bring your kids and you have a picnic and all that. But, of course, Central Park has an incredible actual function of creating, sucking up at least some CO2 and putting back oxygen into the city. It's actually, it's sort of very much like swampland used to be in a great way. It's the natural sort of filter. Yeah,
the lungs of the city.
It is in a great way. And as they, famously say, you can see Central Park from space. It's that
can
large.
You?
Yeah.
Very impressive.
Well, it's because our spy satellites are so good now. I mean, they can make, read license plates.
Because there's so many muggings happening at once.
But they weren't able to catch the Wilding case. I just hope they didn't catch that error that I made over in shortstop.
Yeah. But I have to say, of the Olmsted parks, I have not seen the one in Buffalo, so I have no idea. But our little jewel here in Brooklyn, Prospect Park, is my favorite park in the city. It's just, I like it so much better than Central Park.
Well, actually, I like Central Park better because Prospect is long flat, far as the eye can see fields, whereas Central Park, every three minutes. No,
Prospect Park, it's part of it's the moraine left over from the last ice age. It's got a lot of, you know,
various terrain.
There's the pond down at the bottom. It's a more English park, where Central Park is a more French park.
It's interesting. And they also say that the adage of Olmsted is that he fixed all the mistakes he made in Central Park in Park Slope.
All right, guys. This is sickening here.
It's a very balanced, I mean, really, Park
Patrick's
Slope.
Patrick's just a Manhattan boy, so he's, you know.
It's a smaller park, certainly, much smaller than the scale of Central Park. I mean, you could put Park Slope in the corner of Central Park.
This is nothing balanced about the news coming out of HRN right now. This is pro Brooklyn 100%.
Yeah.
Be in the house.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we are going to take a break. By the way, we are being produced by Jack Tech Radio and also engineered by Nat Wiener, who's aunt is Marsha Wiener. Call in Marsha. Say hi to Nat if you're listening. And I guess we're going to take a break. Are we up to our 7 minutes?
Yep.
I guess we are.
Walking down through the park, I'm gonna walk in the moonlight, walk until the night gets dark. I'm going hard walking down on the avenue. I'm going out walking down on the avenue. I'm gonna walk for so long till she don't know what to do. I'm gonna walk her right side of me, cause I know she can't be beat.
Hey, welcome back to the queue on a rather dreary Sunday afternoon, but at least it's not raining.
Hey, happy summer solstice.
Oh, yes, yes. Longest day of the year, even though we can't see the sun today.
And we have more chance that it'll come out, though.
Yeah. I'm Ed Grant. I'm here with Patrick Martins.
Hey.
Hey. And
I'm here also Mark Marabella.
Yeah, Mark Marabella. I was going to get to that, my friend.
Thank you.
Show's dedicated to the Wolfman.
And we would like to welcome to the show now Maura Rockcastle from Snohetta. It's an architecture and landscape firm. She's been involved with the High Line, which we were talking about earlier.
Awesome.
And also, I believe was a finalist, one of the five finalists for proposals for Governor's Island, for the reuse of Governor's Island. So maybe we'll talk
Love
about
to talk
that a
about
little bit.
That, yeah.
So, Maura, welcome.
Thank you.
So
Thanks
tell us
a
little bit about who and where you come from. Like, tell us how you got to this studio, you know, your academic history and how you got into what you do.
Well, I went to the University of Pennsylvania for grad school in landscape architecture. So technically, I'm a landscape designer. I'm not licensed yet. I can't say I'm a landscape architect yet, but that's the goal. Right after graduation, I went to work for field operations to work specifically on the High Line project. They're the lead designer for the project, landscape architecture, urban design. So I worked on that for 3.5 years and just left in January to go to Snohetta, who's based in Oslo, architecture landscape office with about 18 people here in New York, just getting the New York office off the ground and running. And I'm one of two landscape architects there, so it's totally different. Project scales are different.
What's the range of sort of stuff that you're doing with the firm now?
We're doing a lot of campus buildings, new libraries, and performing arts centers. We've got 3 performing arts centers, Virginia Tech University, North Carolina State University, and Queens University in Toronto. So the landscapes for those are much smaller scale, totally different typology. I've never designed landscapes for universities, campuses. So it's a different user group. And
how does that affect what you do? I mean, are you trying to be more open space-ish? Or are you trying, I mean, how does that affect your work?
What is sort of the aesthetic criteria that you use?
Well, no, it's more like, I bet she has to get the right grass that can handle a lot of hacky sack.
That's part of it.
There's
I mean,
no such grass.
I'm used to really large-scale public projects, which is a lot of the work I did in school and at field operations are huge public infrastructure projects. You know, the High Line being one of them. I also worked a little bit on Freshkills Landfill, which they're turning into a new public park. Shelby Farms Park in Memphis, Tennessee.
They did that in Virginia, too. Virginia Beach. They did that, yeah.
And in Memphis, the park is 4,500 acres, which I think is about 3 times the size of Central Park. So really huge parks, which I loved, but it takes so long in those parks to actually zoom into a more human scale that I was more interested in stepping down in scale and looking at materials and more one-on-one intimate relationship between people and the plants and the furnishings and that kind of thing.
Well, with the High Line, you said you worked yourself, what, 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. How long was the whole process of doing the High Line?
Almost like the history of the High Line, just for our listeners. I mean, lead up to the answer.
I can't imagine as also in relation to that, you can start with the history, but also what did you think when you first heard that they want to make a park out of a train? Basically, how long that length of that train trestle? Essentially,
that's the length. It's 1.5 miles long. Well, it's my first exposure to it, they had a large public competition, open competition, when I was in grad school. So maybe 2004, a group of friends and I in school sent in a proposal for it, along with, I don't know, 200, 300 other proposals.
What was your proposal?
Oh, we don't even need to get into that. There was a lot of informational systems, kind of, you know, the whole thing with the billboards on the structure and doing public art and information and events. And it was much more program-based than it was design-based for our proposal. So, and then 2 years later, they had the invited competition, which Field Operations was one of several teams with Diller Scafidio and Renfro as architects, and they won it. I was an intern in that office when they did the competition, so I worked a little bit on the competition, but I mean, the High Line was built in, I think, the 1930s, and it held, you know, it was phenomenal because it raised the train infrastructure 30 feet above the ground in order to free up crosswalks.
Yeah, it was
and
to get it off grade, right?
Yeah. So it's a much safer solution.
Was that a Penn station? Was that a Penn or was that a subway?
I thought it was. It brought in meat.
Yeah.
To the
meat, milk, yeah. And
so it was
produce.
More like Amtrak than it was the Ford train
freight.
Or something.
Yeah, okay. Okay. And it ran, I think, until the 1980s. The last train ran in 1980.
Really?
It was full of frozen
turkeys. That late. Yeah.
So. And it was actually going to be demolished, and Friends of the High Line, 2 guys, put together a nonprofit organization, and they saved it. They just generated enough interest and support.
Saved it from destruction?
From demolition.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's been an amazing sort of public process. And
was that their argument, that it could get turned into a park? That's why you should save it?
Yeah. And the infrastructure is beautiful, and it's gorgeous, and it's built for a huge amount of weight, and so it serves itself perfectly for a new revitalized green space. And, you know, their whole argument also was that it would change the neighborhoods around it, and city planning did a whole rezoning of the area in order to maximize what kind of buildings and infrastructure they could get out of the new public space.
Mm-hmm. It's a big success story because it's like the Second Avenue subway. Like, people have been talking about since I've been in New York, people talking about the High Line, like, that'll never happen. You know?
When your grandchildren are, you know, having their own little, you know, webcast show, they'll be talking about it too.
Now, is it a safety issue? Because, I mean, sometimes if something is removed high up, separate from the eyes and ears of the streets and people in windows and grandmothers on stoops.
It's definitely a concern. I mean, there's a large security aspect. We had security guys on the team the whole way. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing is designed with that in mind. But it's only open until 10 p.m. in the evening. Okay. So there's some hours restrictions on it. And
I'm sure there's, you know, plenty of video surveillance up there,
there's
too.
There's plenty of, yep. Yeah.
That was my question, actually, too. It's like, I mean, before you came in, you were talking about how I grew up in a rural, relatively rural area where in Buffalo, industrial sort of decay was part of my childhood in fields, and sort of that was natural. Train trestles sort of grew grass on them, and mm-hmm. we played on them. But in a city environment, it's an interesting thing. I mean, number one, it's not, this is an artificial edifice that's sitting on top of steel, which now, I don't know if you did beds or whatever, but also people, there's sort of a liability issue, I think, also with people being up there on at that level, which was meant only for transportation. How did you address those issues?
Well, there's a couple issues in what you just said. One of them, I think I'll start with, is just the landscape that was there when the project started was a totally pioneered landscape. All of the plants came in through birds. And
Yeah, that's one of the things that gave them the idea for a park, wasn't it? Because there was so much stuff growing on its own
already.
It was stunning. It was gorgeous. And the inspiration of just walking up there in the inherent beauty of what it was and what had grown there was so inspiring that it was the only solution that made sense, was to let the public experience that.
Right.
So the field operations proposal wanted to respect that wildness as much as possible. So in scraping it in order to redo the waterproofing and make it something that will last another, 100 years, we removed all of those plants. Actually, the New York Parks Department has a really awesome nursery out in Staten Island. And they do a lot of seed propagation and collection throughout the city. Mm. And so the second part of the High Line will be planted with a lot of those seeds collected from the High Line itself.
Wow. That's
Section one didn't quite get it. It was planted too quickly. Those seeds are still in propagation stages, but a lot of the species are native to what was up there before to ensure that they'll last and be sustainable up there. So that's kind of one part of your question. The second part, I think, was more how do you adapt a space to become something different from industry to public?
Yeah, and because the public's involved, there's safety issues, it's narrow, it's up high. I mean,
well, it's a huge experiment, and I really commend the city for taking it on, because they're monitoring.
Big applause from Manhattan.
Yeah. They're monitoring traffic up there right now. I know they have a lot of concerns about crowds.
Well, if they just want smaller crowds, we can do this one. So this is interesting. I mean, we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, I mean, one of the questions I want to ask is just literally, like, what trees, what plants, how do you fill space? Like, the real how-to, so that if there's a High Line somewhere in Cincinnati, a kid could log on to the Heritage Radio Network site and be like, we need bigger trees or smaller ones. I bet.
Indigenous.
Very fascinating. And the diversity that's there. So we'll be right back with Maura.
With Maura.
Rock
with Maura.
Castle.
Maura. I can't stand the rain against my window, bringing back sweet memories. I can't stand the rain against my window, 'cause he ain't here with me. Hey, window pane, tell me, do you remember how sweet it used to be?
We're back talking about the High Line in Manhattan. I'm back. I'm Mark Marabella.
I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Ed Grant.
And we have...
I wanted the wolf one again. Sorry.
You are the Lobo. Up.
Yeah, what's going on, man? You're feeling all, you know, wild and, you know...
Little rim hit. Mm-hmm. Nice.
No problem.
We're back with Maura. More with Maura. And she is a designer of the High Line in Manhattan, a new park that has been built on a train trestle that's more than... It's a mile and a half, is that right?
Yep.
That's incredible. Is it all open now, a mile and a half of it?
No, about half of that. And it's Gansevoort to 20th Street. So it's the first nine blocks or so.
Wow.
It's perfect if people are walking up the Upper West Side by the water there. They can just, if they're tourists...
It's only, a block in, two blocks in from the water?
Yep.
Yeah. So tell us... First of all, how do you get access for people who are listening in the area? Is there other certain places like a subway where you can walk up there or walk down again?
There's several access points scattered along from the street level up, and they're all very different types and ways of accessing it. Gansevoort Street is one of the primary entrances, 14th Street, and then 18th Street.
Do you allow bikes up there? Can you ride them up there or carry them?
You can't ride them. You can walk them.
Wow.
There's no wheels really permitted, and it's just because it's so narrow, it's a little bit too hard to accommodate that.
So have you seen already, though? I mean, the park's been open a week and there's already, you know, I've read on Curbed and stuff,
wheels
already, no, we hate the High Line, like, you know, because it's New York, man. Yeah, people instantly already course. Are like, nah.
It's fair. I mean, we thought a lot about it. It was a huge part of the discussion and early on in the design, and you know, Hudson River Park is right there, and that's sort of the
I don't think it's necessarily just the wheels thing. I think some people just decided that they weren't going to like it and get all online and complain.
Well, there's always those people, But our whole, you know, strategy was fast. Hudson River Parkway is for the fast speed bikes, wheels, and High Line is for quiet, meandering walking.
Yeah. Is it quiet up there? I haven't been up there. Is it?
It is very quiet. It's astonishingly quiet. But I also wanted to say that I'm one of five designers who worked on the project at Field Operations. So.
Give him a shout out. Who else? Who else worked?
Well, James Corner is the principal at FO, so he's the lead of the design. Lisa Switkin was the project manager. Nayun Huang, who's now the project manager. Sierra Bainbridge. There's Tong Hong Zhu. There's more that have come in and out of the project.
So tell us a little bit about, by the way, that was really interesting. The West Side Highway is super fast for bikes, and the mm-hmm. High Line is like super slow for meandering.
Oh, yeah. It's about the same distance. I mean, and from the...
Yeah, it's a promenade.
Very interesting. So what will people see? Tell us the whole, mm-hmm. like, how did you get the plants? Which plants did you choose? They're like almost A to Z. Like, how does one even go about tackling such a massive project?
Well, we also had on our team horticulturalist planting designer Pete Udolf from the Netherlands. And one of the first things we did was have ecological assessment done. And so we went up there with some biologists and local horticulturalists to walk the High Line, list everything and inventory everything that was up there native. So that went into a huge book, and that fed what plants to choose that we knew would survive.
Like climactically adapted to the region.
And also soil depth,
exactly,
too.
You know? So typically, you know, I think step one was figuring out how much soil can we get up here. Once you add the new layers you need to add, which is a layer of concrete, folded concrete called screed for drainage, the waterproofing layers, the green roof layers, which have water retention, filter fabric. So you get about an inch and a half to 2 inch sandwich in the bottom. You also have to have a bit of a curb on top so you don't have water sheeting over the edge into the streets.
Right.
So we ended up with a typical 14 inches to 36 inches of soil.
Wow.
So it's more of a sort of extensive type of roof garden, which allows us to have a lot more plants, perennials and grasses, and not just the sedums, although we have those in some areas as well.
Is there a barrier between the actual surface of the trestle and the soil?
There is a concrete tub on top of the surface of the steel beams, and then in that are all the sandwiches of...
So some of this wouldn't have been possible like 30 years ago. I mean, with the new materials, like the membranes and the waterproofing mm-hmm. and stuff.
Yeah, it's really high tech now.
Yeah.
So, but so
what kind of plants then?
The plants are, well, we go in a, we have sort of different biotopes up there, and we wanted to be able to go from woodland areas to grassland areas to really spectacular flowering meadows. and that was also in part of the character that was up there to begin with. There's all these microclimates that have been created between areas where the High Line passed through very tall buildings, and it was very close to the outside edge of the High Line where sumac was growing, and what is the tree grows in Brooklyn? Ailanthus. So a lot of really scraggly native taller mm-hmm. trees, and then more open spaces where you had a ton of panicum grass, and there was a huge range up there to begin with. So we just took that and we added to it and multiplied it so that there'd be a huge range of experience.
That's really remarkable that there were microclimates up there based on the architecture around it. So to me, that's jaw-dropping.
We looked at both sun studies and wind studies coming off the river in order to understand and anticipate what additional microclimates we could get and generate. And it starts at Gansevoort in a woodland with a lot of birch and amelanchier, and transitions from there into a couple different types, always going between woodland and grassland and woodland of some kind. But each woodland area is slightly different and catered to its condition. Some are more for birds with, you know, trees with a lot of berries, chokecherry, and so far, we've actually seen a lot of really fantastic things. The minute we got some of the wildflowers in, echinacea, for example, last summer, bees and butterflies and other bugs were everywhere. I mean, you could hear it. It started to buzz up there. It was amazing.
It's fantastic. Who watched the High Line during the years that it was defunct? Like from the 80s when those guys saved it, was there like one old lady or one old guy who would go and like keep things so you didn't need like a machete?
I think the security was pretty lax up there for a long time. I mean, I know I was up there and there was, you heard about it. I mean, it was something people did was, oh, have you, you know, snuck up on the High Line yet?
Right.
And, you know, you could see where the fence had been bent back and you could slide under, and only more recently when it, you know, the design was underway and the transition from CSX rail to the city was made official. I think that was 2005. Did the security really get beefed up?
Because mm-hmm. It was close to the project coming to fruition.
They didn't want any issues.
Things. Yeah.
I would imagine even with all the water absorption and the soil and the layers and the concrete, that still, you know, that is able to bear that weight.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's built for tons and tons and tons of weight. So we didn't have any limitations that most roof structures would have had.
Right, exactly.
Which is great.
Think of a locomotive.
Right.
Yeah. You know, bringing a whole ton of cattle.
Right, exactly.
That's pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Well, and the whole project is also amazing, not just for the planting and the experience of the plantings up there, but for the concrete paving system that was put in, which is all custom. The furnishings are custom, railings are custom, paving is custom. Everything goes above and beyond whatever you see in public parks in the city.
Did the city pay for it? I mean,
the city contributed a huge amount. Friends of the High Line also a huge amount. There's been a lot of really great private donations. And
is there a final tally, or it's free, right, to the public?
Yeah.
Is there a final tally for cost, or is it still ongoing?
I think it was in total maybe $55 million for section one, but I'm not.
And right. That doesn't even include the petty cash receipts that you haven't even.
And cabs were $5 million of that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask also about, you know, it's really interesting that the landscape design aspect you're talking about, going from woodlands to grasslands. Did you give any thought to, I imagine, to seasons? What we might find up there? Is it going to be closed in the winter?
Be open in the winter.
Yeah, I would imagine it's a beautiful, it's a whole different experience in each of the seasons, right? I mean, because New York enjoys that.
Yeah, you know? And the horticulturalist we're working with is one of the best in the world for planning plant design throughout the seasons. So there's a lot of things that are going to be coming up at different months. Every time you go, it will be totally different. Mm-hmm. The bloom color will be different. And a lot of the plants have been chosen both because they're hardy and native, but that also means they have a really strong skeletal winter structure. Mm-hmm. So snow will fall on them differently, and it will be a beautiful textural landscape also in the winter. So.
And did you try to fill up, like, there must have been some empty spaces where there wasn't so much natural stuff growing and you had to fill it up with, like, trees that would fill up or bushes that were big? Or I don't know, like, did you think about, like, just pure aesthetics? Like, what do we need here? We need color here.
A lot of it, because it's so narrow, there is not a huge range for what you can do, but mm-hmm. there's definitely different experiences and views that you have looking outwards. So we went through and we mapped where the spectacular views were in either direction and planted according to those to either celebrate them or enclose the backside of you and push your view towards a more spectacular one that you wouldn't necessarily notice if you were just wandering. So
what about a ceiling? Did you have any limits for yourselves on height? Because if it, obviously a tree can go only so high before its roots, and it could potential of toppling over or branches in the street or anything like that.
We didn't have any height restrictions. There's only all of the buildings that cover the High Line now. We're not planting under them, obviously, because there's no sun, and the openings are quite large. And the new standard hotel that sort of tunnels over it is also extremely high. So yeah. There was no height limitation. I think branching out in certain areas where there's buildings alongside, we were considerate of and have planting set off from the edge. But
well, we're about to take another break, but when we come back, I think we want to ask a few questions about Governor's Island. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Ed Grant.
I'm Patrick Martins.
I am still Mark Marabella.
Excellent. This is the Q Report on Heritage Radio Network. That would be www.heritageradionetwork.com. We're speaking to Maura Rockcastle. We pretty much wrapped up the High Line for now, but we would like to speak to her, one, about her last name, Rockcastle, architect.
It's like a Flintstones name. It's fantastic.
Yeah, but last names, professions. I mean,
yeah, it's beautiful.
That's beers guy.
That's a stage name already, and you were born with it. You don't even have to think of it.
It's perfect.
It's fantastic.
Perfect. Well, and my father is an architect as well, so it's more fitting perhaps for him.
Probably back in the day, somebody, an ancestor of yours, was making castles out of rocks, and that's where your name came from.
Let's hope so.
Yes, but you were involved, sort of, with Governor's Island. You were part of a team that put in a proposal for Governor's Island, and you're a finalist, one of the five.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean, like proposal for Governor's Island? It's a defunct piece of land.
Explain a little bit. Okay. Governor, I can do that if you want me to.
Mark, go for it.
Governor's Island was another island, yet another one, near between Manhattan and or close to in New York Harbor.
Right off of Brooklyn,
before you get to Staten Island. And it was for a long time, it was a base. Coast Guard base. For up until the 90s, technically, right?
Yeah, that's when the last ones pulled out.
Right.
Yeah.
So no one was using it.
And there's great infrastructure in there. There's a golf course. There's beautiful.
It was kept up beautifully.
It's not sort of an old base that was degenerated.
It's not like the Admiral's Row, right? The Navy Yard, which is falling down.
A very old building went down. And as you might imagine, a very old base from Revolutionary times. Obviously.
Oh yeah, there's that one little circular.
There's Castle Williams and Fort Jay. It's beautiful, the historic part of it.
Right, and the Clinton administration, when the Coast Guard finally left, was going to give it to the city for something nominal, like $1, as long as public access was guaranteed. But at the time, we had Pataki as governor and Giuliani as mayor, and we didn't take it at first, and there was all this stuff. Then Trump wanted to put up hotels and a casino.
They wanted to make it a gambling island. Yeah. Everybody was like, no way.
But now it seems like there will be public access. There will be a high school there. Is that what it is?
That's one of the potential occupants. I mean, I think that was the biggest challenge for us working on this. I mean, EDAW had done a master plan for Governor's Island years ago, and it included a significant amount of mixed-use development proposal. But what that was exactly was undefined, and that was part of the brief for these five teams who were submitting a proposal for the public space.
And yours, can you describe yours just a little bit?
Ours was extremely pastoral, I'll say, for lack of other terms. I mean, I think it was considered the most Olmsted-like, which is why we loved it. It was simple, and the whole interior of the southern part of Governor's Island, which is all on fill from subway excavation, so the actual historic part is the northern part, and the main part of the park didn't exist until much more recently. So it's all on, it's fortified fill, and that was where we had proposed a very beautiful surface of undulating rolling meadows, all about bird habitat. You know, you can imagine that an expanse of green in the middle of the harbor would have been just shockingly beautiful.
Yeah. How big a space is it?
I think it's about 160 acres total.
Wow.
I think it's like 72 blocks tip to tip or something like that. It's pretty huge. But it's pretty flat, right?
The topology is
super flat. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So that was an introduction of a bit more of a rolling landscape. Mm-hmm. And part of that was coming from excavating the edges to let the water come into the park a little bit more. We had ideas about cultivating shellfish, which was a huge part of the harbor to begin with.
Yeah. Back in the
mussels
day.
Mussels and oysters. And
but that would have been great.
And our big thing was just expose the elements and make it a super surreal, beautiful place that celebrated the fact that it was floating in the middle of the harbor.
Right. Now, what the project that did win out, what was different about that project than yours? Like, looking back, what was the thing that the city wanted?
Well, the proposal that won was led by West 8 Landscape Architects out of the Netherlands. And their proposal, I wouldn't say it was drastically different, actually. You know, they were pulling water into the park, and they were doing a lot of large-scale flower plantings, and they built a mountain. They're proposing a mountain. Yeah, they're the tulip people. Exactly. The expo. But they proposed a huge mountain in the middle, which would have been rock climbing.
On Governor's Island this summer.
Yeah. God, I mean, it was pretty fantastic.
Who really wants to rock climb?
Rock climbing? Come on, we're walking all day. I don't want to rock climb. You know why? Because all they have is floods over there in dikes, and they want to build a mountain.
It's nice that, you know, we're keeping close to our early Dutch roots here.
That's
making
true.
Making land out of nothing.
That's a good point, Ed. As always, yes, you're absolutely correct.
The Dutch
correct.
Just built those little four steps in order to get to the house. There was no mountain.
Exactly.
But anyway.
Yeah. Yes, but they're the masters at claiming land out of the sea, man.
That's so true. That's a good point.
Another big part of their proposal had a lot to do about bikes. They made a pretty sweet
and skating on pikes? Skating on canals? Oh, yeah, bikes. Yeah, that makes sense.
They did put a canal through the middle, I think, too.
Weird.
But it was carefree, and it had a lot of interesting things happening in it, which ours was a little bit more subtle.
You were happy, though, that they won in a way, because if not...
Well, I wouldn't say happy. I wasn't happy they won. However...
You're an anti-monopolist when it comes
yeah,
to...
Yeah, I mean, field operations, as beautiful as the proposal was, you know, we're already doing the High Line in Freshgills Park and East River Plaza. We're doing a lot of really amazing new landscape projects in the city, and so part of the idea against having us do also Governor's Island is that then you have one firm designing all of these new key spaces in the city, and it's nice to have some diversity in that.
I like
for New
it.
York.
You're like, I'm kind of happy they didn't win, and by the way, I quit.
I wanted to ask, actually, well, first of all, Ed or Patrick, Mr. New York City Gay.
Born and raised.
Maybe you know this question. Is Governor's Island part of what borough? Is it part of a borough?
New Jersey. Are you going to tell me, like, Statue
I'm not
of
asking. I don't know the answer. No, I'm honestly asking.
I don't think it was part of a borough until
they
took it over.
Yeah,
I don't know. Because it was federal property before. So,
do you know the answer? True. Or do you?
Yeah, it probably was. It was federal property, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess it's true. I wanted to ask her about actually Fresh Kills, which is very interesting. Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, that brings up so many other design questions and issues, because having driven by it quite often to and fro D.C. and back to New York, you know, they have obviously methane and all sorts of issues that they see. It's as they say, a mature landfill. Now they need to do something with it. So tell us, like, what, you know, the idea of people. I was familiar with that, actually. Having spent some time in Virginia, that they have this beautiful park they have that people, it's known for its kite flying because it's got this, it's in Virginia Beach, and which has this great wind, and it's a tidewater, so it has this great wind, and because it's in this gigantic landfill, it's up high, and there's always these beautiful kites, but you say, like, how could you take your kids to what used to be a landfill? So how do you, you know, overcome those sorts of issues?
Well, it's a that project has been going on for a long time, and it will continue to go on for a long time. I mean, I know that funding's an issue. It's a huge bureaucratic mess, actually, which I don't know much of the details about, but I know that we've been working on it for years and years, and recently it's sort of been slowed down a bit. So,
did it get delayed also because of September 11th and taking all the...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It didn't delay the design process at all, but they did put a lot of the refuse in one of the mounds.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a really beautiful memorial garden as part of the design in that location as well. But they phased it so that you would start in small parts and grow new soil over time, and a lot of biking and golf. You know, there's a lot of room out there to do some more extreme sports that we don't have in the city.
Excellent.
So we're going to actually come back. Mara, hopefully you can stay, you know, and sit in this chair. But we're going to have Thomas Hunt come on and talk a little bit about the real nitty-gritty policy sides of education and green spaces and youth programs, and maybe there'll be a connection
the youth programs.
The youth, yeah, that's all the about youth.
The youth. Is that all from that one movie, My Cousin Vinny?
Or because it's all over Brooklyn.
Yeah,
which
we
love.
Yo,
thank
Brooklyn.
You so much.
It was a pleasure.
Mara, you're awesome.
Hey, Mara,
Mara Rockcastle.
She rocks. I'm Patrick Martins.
Mark Marabella.
And Ed Grant.
We should thank Gabe Rosner for getting us these awesome guests
today. We love
today.
Gabe, friend of the show.
Friend of the show. He could
owner,
be in here right
one,
now.
One owner of Roberta's.
Nah, he's having a good time, just chilling.
We should also thank Maura Rockcastle.
She's still here.
She was a great guest, but also I think by far the best name we've had.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
But today we have Thomas.
It was also thematically appropriate for green spaces, not just the name.
But now we have Thomas Hunt, who's here with us.
Awesome. And he is a policy analyst,
yes.
Correct, for the city of New York?
Correct, for the public advocate of New York.
You might be my first real live wonk.
Well, happy to be the first.
Excellent.
Tell us, what do you so do? Much what does talk that about. Mean? What does that mean to say that you're right. a policy
analyst? How does it relate to green spaces and the Highline we were just discussing in your office?
Okay, well, that's... I think I can make that connection. But my boss, the public advocate of New York, is one of three citywide elected officials. So she's not a legislative politician. So what we do is just mostly advocacy and being a watchdog over city services. Mm-hmm. So in one area where that might tie to green space is just simply kind of advocating for, you know, use of space and that kind of thing. But also paying attention to... the way decisions are made about what the city is going to do with public space. And so there is a specific process. I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's the Uniform Land Use Review process. It's something that if it is circumvented, then we might weigh in and say that this is not an acceptable way of the city doing business.
But so who do you weigh in with?
Well, so, I mean, this kind of is... the crux of what we do. You know, we kind of analyze the way things were done, and we say, you know, this is where it broke down, and this is where, you know, it could be fixed, or this is just unacceptable, you have to redo this whole thing.
Mm. Like suddenly there's a proposal for a 50-story building going up somewhere, you know, that some private developer bought and just kind of did.
Sure. I mean, that's a good example. I mean, there is a very clear process that, you know, kind of started, I guess, 40 years ago or so, which is a fairly good government process and kind of making sure that the community and the city and the development is all kind of on the same page.
So that's Jane Jacob doesn't have to do it all by herself. She can actually have an established entity.
Yes. So what we have now with this mayor is kind of Robert Moses meets Jane Jacob and, you know, big ideas. And I think that an example of where it kind of or overlaps with what I do, which is primarily kind of youth and education related work. A good example of where the system or the process was kind of circumvented is Randall's Island, which is, you know, a big green space, which is primarily, and in its conception and in a major way, was all about sports and, you know, soccer.
And let's just talk about who created that island.
Patrick and I have a history there.
I still have syringe marks from diving out in center field.
We played baseball there from 80s. 10 years ago.
Yes, but Randall's Island as the Cosmos. A park, who did that?
Well, I guess I would say Robert Moses.
Yes, but, yes.
You mean the one under the bridges that he said he couldn't do anything else with?
Well, and also his secret bunker underneath,
exactly. His office was in the Triborough Bridge, right?
Yeah.
No, I am there once a week, actually. I play soccer at night, and you wait for the bus at 11 o'clock.
Yeah, now Circus Soleil is going to be there now, right?
Well, they're there now, I mean, it certainly seems
and
like...
And Ringling Brothers, I think, is actually doing it from there. They're not doing MSG.
It's a very cool space for New Yorkers who haven't been there, actually. It's interesting and unique, I think, Randall's Island.
Yeah, well, it's totally bizarre, and it certainly serves a function. But the process that was kind of circumvented there was that the city... This is an arrangement that I'm sure that Maura can speak more about, but the kind of public-private partnership is something that is necessary to a large degree, but it is that's the way Randall's Island is run. And the idea recently, there's an idea that, well, you know, there's a lot of different competing interests here. There's a lot of different, you know, people, youth groups that need access to this field or to these fields. You know, how do we make that work? And the city kind of unilaterally decided that, well, we'll sell 80% of the field space between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m. to all of the private schools, primarily a consortium of private schools in Manhattan, that would cover the cost of the renovations and also the upkeep of the parks in perpetuity, I guess. That naturally created a major outcry, especially among, you know, kind of the more active public school parents and other people that were vying for use of the space. They filed a lawsuit, they won, and now they're back to the drawing board. And
does that affect with you guys? So would they come to you to file the lawsuit?
Well, they would come to us for advocacy. And I think that, you know, to a large degree, you know, we have an ability to amplify issues, and we'll do that to the best of our ability, but also use like a certain amount of our expertise to kind of weed through the nitty gritty of
I'm always amazed anything gets done in New York. There's so much to be done. So many different factions.
Do you have a veto power? I mean, you're mainly, you can go to the press, you can mm-hmm. give someone a platform, you can make someone into a Jane Jacobs in a way, if you believe it. And who is that committee?
Jane Jacobs, by the way, is the mother of, theoretically, of urban planning.
Yeah. In the New York area,
West Village. Ken Burns.
No. Urban planning existed long before her.
Okay, but
it was community activism in the face of...
Yes,
you know, in gigantic the face of, developers.
As we're talking about Jacob Javits.
Hey, no, I've no, read the book.
That's correct.
Know, Moses turned into evil without the power a doubt. Broker. But you know, if when he started, he was actually a really active, good government kind of guy.
And Jacob Javits
just got
the former
more and more
senator.
Corrupt the older he got, and more power he got.
Mm-hmm. During Rick Burns's 30-hour documentary on New York, the only
29
I cried twice, and one was during the Jane Jacobs, like where she
famously there's me being from Niagara Falls. There's a famous highway up there, the Jacob Javits Highway, that literally just ends. It just you know, it's four lanes. It goes in the Niagara escarpment and just ends.
It just ends.
Yeah, as now we're coming back to. Do you guys deal with road issues? A lot of it. I mean, you know, we're coming back a lot now, ironically, to that GM has imploded, and we're coming back now to new different land uses, as it was with Randall's Island is a great example, actually, that it was sort of left as it was. Are you guys dealing with those issues in green spaces and pulling back traffic and cars new building of roads and... I mean, as an example, again, back to Highline, this was a transportation...
No, or also the community in the late 90s, you know, during the end of the Giuliani administration, there was a big thing about community gardens and how they were being sold or taken away. I mean, the public advocate in that role of amplifying the voice of, you know, small groups of individuals, was that a role that...
Well, certainly. I mean, the public advocate position is a relatively new position in New York. So Betsy, my boss, Betsy Gottbaum, is... the second public advocate.
Mark Green was
Mark
the first?
Green, yeah. Yes, he was the first and potentially the third.
He was there
for
a long time, though.
Well, he was there for 8 years. I mean...
is there a term limit?
Well, there was, and that's a whole other issue where this mayor has kind of...
We're not going there.
We don't have to go
there's
there.
There's a public smackdown right now between Betsy and Christine Quinn.
Yes, there is. Rightfully so, I suppose. Yeah. But
he's right, but that's in my opinion.
Yeah, we don't have to go there. But certainly, you know, the you know, advocating for people and kind of what they want to do. And I think that, you know, this mayor has been a little more focused on, or maybe even just a little more correct on certain issues in terms of use of space and that kind of thing. And certainly the 2030 plan is something that we weighed in on and saying that this is a wonderful thing, especially the congestion pricing, and that kind of gets back to your road
use. Is that
the
Plan NYC or whatever?
Yeah, Plan NYC.
What's the 2030? So people
there are these, you know, every politician will put these kind of, you know, arbitrary dates on everything. So, like, complete all of this grand planning by this date, and it's 2030 for the mayor's plan, which... congestion pricing was actually something that we really kind of got behind and supported, even though it was politically kind of...
I think it was the most brilliant thing that we could have done, and the fact that it didn't happen is appalling.
I mean, our position actually was that he wasn't going far enough, and that, you know, 75% of, you know, the workforce in New York City doesn't actually work in that area of Manhattan, and that there's things that you can do with the BQE and other places around the city that, you know, should really be explored. But ultimately, you know, we are an incorporated entity of the state, and the state is, you know, the Michigas that we have to deal with.
Can I ask one specific Brooklyn question, which is close to between...
Is Prospect Park the best? Is that
well,
what you're
we,
about?
We, no, we,
well,
that, established
that's
that.
Answered.
And Laura
no, we know that question. That's yes
be
is the answer.
Be prepared for a lot of sound effects
the question,
during this.
The question is, it runs the BQE that runs between Ed and I. They're asking for... proposals for that space. Are you aware of that?
Oh, underneath that. Yeah. You know,
it's on Park Avenue.
The viaduct part,
on Park
Avenue where it's raised.
And, yeah.
There's this whole plan now about what they're going to do under it
right.
and revitalize
it. Yeah, they're
and
asking for proposals.
Yeah,
and
Pratt had a little event down there 3 weeks ago now, I guess. So,
it's a weird space, but it could, you know, it's a very specific thing.
It's
tough.
So this is the old Navy Yards? Or?
Yes.
It's between the Navy Yard and Clinton Hill.
Where the BQE is up above there, where it's running down Park Avenue. It's sort of like, it's very much like the Highline, but underneath would be very noisy. I mean, it is very noisy.
This is like the equivalent of a comment box. You have the policy analyst here. You're like, we have this little area that's over. It'd be a lot easier for us to visit each other if something could be done with that.
It's a great idea.
How
How this is a very specific question. How did the public advocate become the mayor in waiting, basically,
and
the
who
next
are
in
they?
Succession? Yeah. I mean, how did that happen?
How do they determine what's right and wrong versus the mayor or something like
just
that?
A,
you know,
just a speaker.
Well, so what happened was the public advocate was a position that was created in the 89 charter revision, I guess. But he or she was the president of the city council.
Okay.
And if you kind of go back and look at all the different charter revisions in the last 100 years, you see a tremendous consolidation into of power into the mayoralty of New York City. Mm. And the 89 revision was probably the one of the biggest in the last 100 years. But what it did do as kind of a concession or a political favor, perhaps, I don't know, was to take this position out of the city council, have it be, you know, something that was providing a little bit of oversight and watchdoggery, whatever, over the mayor and his agency, and also is the next in line, should anything happen. But, you know, didn't give it an independent budget and kind of stripped it of all of its like legislative power.
Yeah, that's it. Just seems
it's like,
you know,
the Supreme Court without the power to legislate, right? Yeah. Because they kind of are the jury of what's right and wrong, what deserves.
Well, I think it's more like the Inspector General without kind of like teeth. So, you know, we try to
the government accounting office.
Yes.
Now we only have a few minutes left. I kind of maybe just jumping off green spaces because it's so fascinating, and hopefully you'll be back. But as a teaser for what you might talk about, just tell us really some of the things that you do that you're passionate about, why you got into this, and you know, lead into for when the next time you're here.
Sure. I mean, you know, I was a teacher and kind of turned towards policy by working for a city council member, and felt like, you know, I could kind of do more things with youth and education in that position, and focus on some of the kind of political things that I was interested in. I think that there is enormous opportunity in the city, obviously. I mean, this what you guys are doing here is great stuff. There are amazing organizations in this neighborhood alone. There, this neighborhood has more youth in it than any other district in the city.
Interesting. Wow.
And so these are you know, certainly people that need to be engaged, and I think that green space, you know, is a perfect place to do that, because, you know, there's a certain amount of being able to define what you are doing and how you're, you know, self-determination in your community and that kind of thing.
And if we have any kids out there listening, what are the steps that they would go through to get to the position, you know, working at a high-powered city job like this? What would you recommend for them?
I think it's twofold. I think you need to support the ideas, and I think you also need to, you know, put some political or policy heft behind it, that there is, like, funding and resources, and there are opportunities to do things where youth are kind of, you know, reconnecting and repurposing the space that is in their communities. And that's certainly something through the schools and through the organizations that are just kind of doing good and ancillary work in the communities. But
excellent. And now tell us about Gabe. What exactly is his role? Is Betsy Gottbaum, is she safe when he's driving?
Well, that's a really good question. I think
just a chauffeur, or, you know, really he has special forces training and, you know, he can just take anybody out at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, I mean, I think he can do that. I mean, he's not allowed to tell us,
right?
So but I would imagine he could. You know, he wears a three-piece suit, he has great glasses, he's got a good mustache. I mean, I think
true.
He's very intimidating.
Is it true that much of the policy of Betsy is affected by conversations with Gabe as he's driving around? Is that true?
Well, what he told us.
Well, yeah. It's absolutely.
He's the wizard behind the curtain.
Yeah. Well, if anyone has FaceTime, he's got more FaceTime than any of us. And I think, you know, he is certainly driving this train.
literally. So
much. Literally.
Yes.
Well, when we come back, I thank you, Thomas, for helping make something that seems a little odd to a lot of people a lot clearer.
Yeah.
And when we come back, I guess we'll be having a Father's Day conversation with the man who raised Martin.
Dads and lads.
Yikes.
Happy Father's Day.
Supermarket, I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for a special other county personality. I wasn't born so much as I fell out. Nobody seemed to notice me. We had a hedge back home in the suburb over which I never could see. I heard the people who live on the ceiling scream and fight or scarily. Hearing that noise was my first ever feeling. That's how it's been all around me. I'm all lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for a special offer, a guaranteed personality. I'm all tuned in, I see all the programs. I save coupons and packets of tea. I've got my giant hit discotheque album. I empty a bottle, I feel a bit free. Kids in halls and the pipes in the walls make me noises for company. Long distance callers make long distance calls. Silence makes me lonely. I'm lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for the special offer, a guaranteed personality. It's not here.
So here we are back on the Q Report.
We're back. All of a sudden, it's like FM radio. Hello, welcome to the Quiet Storm. I'm Mark Mirabella.
I'm Patrick Martins, and Ed is sitting off on the side. And we're going to do a little shout-out to dads. It's Father's Day. I'll open things up. My father is a concert pianist in Brazil. He's Jean Carlos Martins. My parents divorced when I was like one, so I was never very close with them. But I do respect his genetics for creating me. I'm healthy and all that, so I guess I owe a lot
to him. It's fun to watch him at Carnegie Hall, too.
It's fun to watch him. He gives me free tickets, at least. He does that. He gives up that end of the bargain. And all right. Let's throw it over to Jack, who is our producer.
Hey, Jack. Hello. Like to say happy Father's Day to my father, Peter Inslee, who is with both of my brothers right now. I think they're helping him refurnish the apartment. So hello to all of them.
Well, wow, quite the Father's Day task.
Yeah, no, no.
Where is that?
I'm at work. He's in Bayside, Queens right now. Nice. So.
It's okay. Thankfully, it's not raining, or I guess it's a little humid, but it could be worse.
Could be worse.
Yeah. Awesome. So what's his name again?
Peter. Peter Inslee. Peter happy Father's Day.
Nice. Do you want to...
Thomas?
Sure. Yeah. Happy Father's Day, Dad. Kevin Hunt. I think he's up in Maine today. I hope it's nice weather. I hope you're in New
Englander. All right.
Yeah. Their growing season is just about ending now. It's already June.
No, it's just starting. August.
Oh, okay.
If you're not fishermen.
And happy Father's Day to Garth Rockcastle. Home briefly, supposed to be going back to Russia. Should be in Hyattsville, Maryland. I love you. Happy Father's Day.
Wow, Maura. I thought Maura had the best name. Her dad has the best name.
I know.
Garth Rockcastle. He could have done anything with that.
Actually, could you move down one seat? We'd like this seat to be reserved for Garth.
That's a great name.
And we have one more father here,
yes,
Mark.
Yes, my dad, Alphonse. A very, Alphonse, Al Marabella is on the line. Al, are you with us? Dad.
I am. I'm sitting here listening to all this. I'm not a concert pianist.
Nor happy Father's Day.
Well,
yes, but you
I do
fathered...
travel the world, but not,
yes, but
as, not as a mission or whatever.
But as a high school teacher, you fathered three of your own children, and how many dozens or probably hundreds of kids that came through? And how long you taught for what, 35 years?
Yeah.
So how many kids did you think?
Well, probably 120 a year or so, some bigger, some smaller, but probably around 125 a year, something like in that nature. And some have, you know, really amazed you that do very well. They come back and thank you. But the fact is they wait until you retired before they come back and thank you. But it was a very rewarding career. I loved teaching.
Well, I always remember as a kid walking around on the streets or in the mall or wherever we were, and you know, the kids would come up. And I said, Dad, you taught them, and it would be like they would be the grandmothers because they have children of the children. But you had many generations in Buffalo.
When I would recognize a family name of kids I had, and I said, well, I must have taught your father. Was his name Arcel or whatever? And they would say to me, oh, that's my grandfather. And I said, oh, God, am I that old? Oh, God. or rather, are they having children that young too? So it could be either way. But anyway,
did you ever see that Kevin Kline movie where the kid wins the Oscar and is like, "I want to thank my teacher"? I mean, not that. Well, that's not what happened with you, but I'm just saying that was funny.
I could tell you this story. They honored me at a luncheon or whatever the other day, and somebody I had taught came up to me as a student and said, and he was a teacher, was a teacher's group, and he said to me, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "No, I don't. Of course, I think of you as 12 or 14, and now you're whatever." And anyway, when I got to speak, I was going to say, I said, "You know, a fine young lad came up here and he says to me, 'I'm a teacher,' and you know," I said, "but you know, he never did say, 'I'm the one that inspired him to be the teacher.'" I didn't say that.
But that's okay. You know, I did teach with you also for a year when I got out of school, and that was actually very inspiring. I was pretty down in the dumps, and so thank you for inspiring me.
Well,
I went on. All the kids said, "You know,
that was an or else."
Yeah, well, the else worked, and all the kids I remember when I was teaching, I said, "Yeah, I'm going to go to New York and write scripts," and they said, "Oh, you're going to go be a bum." So. And I sent back all their letters back to all my kids. I wrote an essay and about their dreams, and I sent it back to them in 10 years. So that was, you were very inspiring, and you inspired a lot of kids and well, your own kids as well. What are you doing today for Father's Day?
Thank you. Well, I was sitting around waiting for a phone call to come through, and lo and behold, there it was.
Yeah.
Your sister's having me over for dinner later, and I was out in my gardens. You know, I like to work in the gardens.
Yes, and that's perfect because, you know, also to have you on today, we're talking about green spaces, and of course, grew up all our life with the yard and you planting all kinds of.
And how many times I said, "No, you cannot play ball in the backyard, and don't go in the garden."
Yeah.
Are you?
That's what it is to live in the suburbs, right?
Are you proud of Mark?
In the yard.
I'm sorry, what?
Are you proud of Mark?
Oh God, yes. Oh, of course. I always. All my children are proud. My one daughter had worked for hospice for 14 years, and that's a very difficult situation.
And your other daughter is also a teacher.
Is a teacher,
right?
And you know, she was going to be she was working on her PhD to be a research medical whatever. She was working on cancer research when she decided to become a teacher. And oh no, all of them. And I've always said to them, especially Mark will know, you know, if you have to choose your own careers in life because you work at it for 40 or 50 years, whatever you work at it, and if you don't enjoy it, it's just a grief every day you get up. So
yes.
So did you tell them about the time you were an accountant?
I never actually became one.
Well,
more like the time that I stopped.
I mean, I was practically there.
Yeah, practically. Anyway. I unfortunately do more of it than I prefer even now.
So the
other company.
So the others, like I said, I'm glad the children all have something that they've chosen that they like to work in, and so forth and so on. And I'm happy for them. Oh, yeah, I'm very proud of all of them. Oh, yes, yes, all of them. Yes, especially. Hello. What was that? I'm sorry.
That was applause.
Oh, well. Are we still on or no?
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, especially when I'm proud of them is that when they don't write me and ask for checks and things and say, "Dad, you know, I'm back 2 months' rent," so I know everything's going well when I don't get a letter or a call.
Yeah, exactly. No news is good news, right?
What's that?
No news is good news.
There you go. There you go.
Well, then, happy Father's Day. We're wrapping up the show now.
Happy Father's Day.
And same to you and all your fathers who may or may not be listening.
I'm a future father to be. I'm sure I'll be calling more than that.
Mm. Yes, well, I'm very thrilled at that. I can't tell you how happy I am about that.
Thank you.
Yeah,
awesome,
good,
and we will be back for the another Q Report next week. Very exciting. What is next week's show?
Fancy food.
Fancy food.
Oh yeah, the fancy food show.
It's very exciting.
Oh my God!
If you had a pound of butter, it'll be fine.
Exactly. We'll talk about butter for the whole hour.
But
I don't have any guests.
All right, guys. Great show.
Yeah, great show. A lot of fun. Thank you for being on.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye bye.
Thank you all. Bye bye.
Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home.
And when he died,
all he left was well alone. Oh, Papa was a rolling stone, my son. Yeah. Wherever he laid his hat was his home.
And when he died,
all he left was well alone.
what you say, that Papa never worked a day in his life.
And Mama...